And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and with me is Phil Conlon.
Yes.
How are you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil.
And today we're going to talk about, with Thomas Mountain in Eritrea, about developments in the Horn of Africa and a new film. And we'll also talk to Imam Mogara about the news in East Congo. The headlines are that the Rwandan government is backing a very extreme, very aggressive action taking place by a phony rebel group that they sponsor. At any rate, the U.S. and Britain are mum on the issue, and we want to find out why. And in the latter half of the program, we're going to talk to Rick Ross of StopNATO.com about NATO's getting involved now along the Syrian border, which would have implications for Canada. So yesterday, Toronto won the Grey Cup, and the city is celebrating by giving the mayor more time to practice football. And I think that's generous and thoughtful of them. And I don't know, is there maybe a letter from Don Cherry saying that he was the greatest mayor ever and all the Pinkos should drop dead? And I don't know if he's going to speak up. He doesn't live here, but he knows what's best for us. And if you remember when we inaugurated this mayor, the speech was given by a guy in a funny costume. He said he was Don Cherry, who told us all off. And anyway, I assume he'll be standing next to the mayor now. Ex-mayor. Next to the ex. Anyhow, we'll find out about that. But Phil, while we're getting Mr. Mountain, maybe you have an announcement of laborers showing some films.
Yes, there's an annual festival called the Canadian Labor International Film Festival. It started last weekend, actually. We're sorry we didn't have the announcement for you last week. It'll be this Saturday and Sunday at Innes Town Hall. That's at 2 Sussex Avenue, which is in the St. George and Bloor area. And it's from 2:30 to 8:30 on Saturday and on Sunday. And on Saturday, the last film, which is going to start, I think, approximately around 5:30, is The Killing Floor, which is a landmark documentary about racism in the meatpacking industry that came out in 1984. And they've made a new takes on it, new prints of it, and it's going to be seen now for the first time in 25 years. So go to www.laborfilms.ca and get the schedule and find out all about the Canadian Labor International Film Festival. Also this week, on Thursday at 7 p.m. at the Central Library in Mississauga, Friday at 1 p.m. at Ryerson University, the Oakham Lounge, and at 7:30 at OISE, the Stop the Drone War, an eyewitness report by U.S. anti-war leader Joe Lombardo on the recent American anti-drone delegation to Pakistan. So those are two of the announcements. I have one more later on.
So, just to reprise what we're going to talk about here, because these are big stories, definitely. We want to get Thomas's view of... start with the fact that there's a new film been made about, apparently, it's making the rounds of, in the, this, something you know a lot about, Phil, the international film, there seems to be a festival going all the time of somebody.
And in this city, it's every day of the year.
Yeah, and it's good stuff, by the way.
It is.
And there's apparently a film been made about Eritrea, and... I think Thomas might be in this. We'll have to ask him, but he's certainly high on the film. And Thomas Mountain writes for Counterpunch, if you know their site. Counterpunch is the creation primarily of Alexander Coburn, who recently passed away and was a fantastic journalist. And that site is maintaining high-quality, important reportage. There's where you will find the writings of Thomas Mountain. and on the story, the Rwanda story, there is a site, the Congo, I have to find their names, but there's a Congolese organization which is now taking up the cudgels on the matter of Rwanda's aggression. And this latest thing is very, very serious, and that's why we're going to be talking to Imam Mogara about it. The There's people who are reporting on the scene say that these are not what you call, when people hear the word rebel or they hear the word guerrilla, they tend to picture military organizations where they don't have uniforms or proper uniforms, and they don't have the same type of weaponry. It depends on, you know, individuals. In this case, actually, you have brand new uniforms, according to the journalists who've seen them. They're nicely pressed. They have brand new boots. The Rwandan army is quite partial to a high kind of fishing boot style. It comes about just under the knee. It's perfect for damp areas. And everybody always used to note that that was the signature of the RPF. I don't know if they'll change that now that we know that they tune in to Taylor Report. But anyhow, so they are, and they have very advanced weapons. And so continue to call these guys rebels is infuriating, because they are actually apparently commanded by the Minister of Defense of Rwanda. So it's not your ordinary rebel that gets that kind of support. I think we're joined now by Thomas Mountain. Are you there, Thomas?
Yes.
Hey, thanks. It's great to hear you. And I'm glad you're available, and I know we're keeping you up late in Eritrea. I read an article by you, quite fascinating. There's a new documentary film. It almost sounded like you might be in it, but it's tell us about this film first.
Well, there's a documentary produced by award-winning documentarian or award-winning producer Afshin Ratansi. He produced it for Press TV. Afshin produces the Double Standards program every week, which is shown on...
That's an excellent program.
Yes, I think it's my favorite program. And so he came out here for the week before. He and a crew came to Eritrea the week before Eritrean Independence Day this year, in the end of May. And Afshin, they were here. They've been all over the country. They saw the youth in the streets during the carnival period before the Independence Day. They saw firsthand what was going on. And they captured it on tape. And the usual very skeptical, Afshin's crew is usually a skeptical lot. And they were won over by the sheer magnitude of the nationalistic high that the Eritrean youth were on. And people were here on this Independence Day every year. And I got to share, not that I wasn't in the documentary or anything, but I was here. I knew they were here. And we were all together here during Independence Day. And it was really great having somebody capture it, because I'd been living here for 6 years. And it was sort of like one of these events every year that you sort of wonder, wow, the way they talk about Eritrea outside, the way it really is, and the way we can see it, and how the people are, you know, basically really happy and joyous about the way the country is. Mm-hmm. You know, and Afshin caught this. So, you know, like I say in the article, the only regret I really had was that the time slot that they put documentaries in Press TV is only 25 minutes. So,
but a person could go to Press TV, and then they go to the name of the show again is.
Well, if you just punch in Eritrea, a nation in isolation. Mm-hmm. And just punch that in, and then there'll be a whole bunch of YouTube links come up, and you can go and see it. You can see it right off the YouTube on the internet. Just punch in Eritrea, a nation in isolation.
A nation in isolation.
It'll come up. Yeah, a nation in isolation. Mm-hmm. They're trying to isolate us, but it's not working.
Yeah. Well, indeed. Well, it's interesting that you should raise this, because, of course, Press TV is being given, they're being hounded, actually, by the British government, trying to prevent them from broadcasting, right? And you can see why.
They've actually been, Press TV is now, not only was it removed from the Sky platform by the British government, arm of the British government, but now it's been removed from the European market. You can no longer see it in Europe. It's been apparently by a secret order by the European Commission. They said to get rid of the satellite providers, so you can only get Press TV in Europe and Britain by internet. Now, it's interesting because Press TV includes Ashwin Ratansi's program, Double Standard. Ashwin was worked for the BBC for many, many years and won a number of awards with the Bound Bang File and other programs.
Yep.
Press TV had George Galloway's program, and George is probably one of the leading British critics of the British and United States in the British Parliament now.
Yep.
For this overwhelming victory he had recently. And it includes a whole bunch of other people that, you know, basically very prominent critics. It has Max Kaiser, who is an American economic and analyst. Max's report has been
Max is a treat, isn't he?
Yeah, Max is Max. Mad Max, I call him. But he's, you know, he's got his financial analyst.
No, you're right. That's a bunch of bunch of terrific programs.
Prominent critics. Yeah, prominent critics that they've taken off the air, and then they sit around and talk about freedom of the press and freedom of speech, and then how this is being restricted in the rest of the world, yet they just took three of the biggest critics and said, no, nobody can watch them anymore.
Yeah.
So I think this is where things are headed. I mean, I don't know about Canada and U.S. today, but I'm pretty sure still that Al Jazeera is something that's not available to most people in Canada and the United States.
Yeah.
In directly by their satellite or by their cable TV.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Press TV is not on there, and a whole bunch of channels aren't on there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they sit around and like to spout about freedom of the press. You know, I'm sitting here in East Africa, and I can click on, like, seven different news channels. I can click on the standard CNN and BBC and France 24 and Euro News, and then I've got Al Jazeera English, and I've got Press TV in English, and I've got now Chinese CCTV in English.
Yeah. What the...
and I've got Japanese international news in English, and I've got Korean international news in English. And I can see all these things, and I get to hear, you know, the voice of all these different governments and people around the world. You can't get most of these channels in America and Canada, and yet they're the biggest ones saying, oh, we've got freedom of the press. No, you don't.
Nope.
Because you've got freedom of the liars, that's all.
Yeah. Well, actually, yeah, I was going to say, I mean, we envy you because this is actually the heart of darkness. As a matter of fact, we sponsor darkness. We don't, you know, Press TV is telling the world things, so we try to take them off the air so that they can't bring any light.
Yeah.
No, it's a nasty situation. Thomas, I know our listeners, many of them very fond of you and read your articles and love to hear you talking about matters. Can you tell us, what do you make of the present confrontation developing between NATO and Syria and Turkey and these folks? Are you following that, and what do you make of it?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, you know, sometimes I see some people gushing about Syria and trying to make Syria out to be this, very progressive leadership. And no, Syria, the government of Syria was infamous for being brutal and corrupt. I mean, the Syrian intelligence was always one of those outfits that, you know, people always talked about in hushed tones because of the brutality. The Syrian government has, in the past, has brought artillery up and shelled Palestinian refugee camps as well as their own people in homes, killing tens of thousands of people with artillery. So, I mean, you know, the richest man in the country was the cousin of the president. So, you know, it's a long history of Syria being an opportunist and really nasty. I mean, Americans were sending renditioning people to Syria to be tortured. You know, so I mean, so it's like, again, the Americans turn around and say, oh, now Syria's a brutal regime, we should overthrow them. Well, you know, the reality is most of the people coming fighting in Syria against the government are not Syrian. I mean, I think that's a fact that's been pretty well established. It includes people that have big Al-Qaeda links. You know, that's a fact. That's been pretty well established. So, you know, as in the case in Libya, it's mainly an external forces. Of course, you know, there is a basis within the country for people to support them. Otherwise, these rebels wouldn't be able to operate inside the country if they don't have civilian support. But, you know, it is mainly an external thing driving it, and I think it's part of this effort to isolate and destroy the Iranian government, because Syria is their main ally in the Arab world. So, you know, Turkey's on board, and there's some really nasty things going on. And you know, it's pretty, you know, the reality was after the oil-rich regimes in the Arab world, including Libya and Saudi, the Gulf region, Syrians, standard of living among the Syrians was probably the highest after, after the really oil-rich countries, was probably the highest in the Arab world.
Mm-hmm.
And Syria was very self-sufficient economically. They produced all their own energy, pretty much. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, they import electricity from Turkey, but they were selling the Turks their oil in exchange and other things. So, you know, Turkey has moved into a very, very reactionary role in the region, and it's going to come back to bite Turkey. I think Turkey's going to see that this is going to turn into something that among their own Kurdish population, the Kurds of mm-hmm. of Syria and Iran and Iraq are all going to get more united as a result of this, and Turkey's going to end up really regretting the genie they let out of the bottle. But, mm-hmm. you know, and then the Turkish people are very clearly in opposition to what their government's doing in regards to supporting this external intervention in Syria. And, you know, they can see, the Turkish people can see this is not in their interest to have this war next door at their neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's a part of the, you know, Western generally, you know, I mean, they can be your best friend one minute and turn around and be calling all kinds of names the next minute.
Yeah, they say if you're going to have lunch with the devil, use a long spoon. But this is Thomas Mountain, by the way. I want to make sure everybody knows. You can read Thomas's articles, Counterpunch, but of course, just go to Thomas Mountain and you'll find him. But Thomas, what about now? We've had the bombing of Gaza, attacks on Gaza, and I'd like to know what you are hearing there in Eritrea and what your thoughts are about it.
Well, you know. To tell you the truth, I think this Gaza, you know, people are saying it's a victory. I mean, we live in here in Eritrea. Eritrea fought a 30-year independence war, which started after World War II about the same time as the Palestinians. And there was a huge Holocaust in Eritrea that was carried out, you know, with the occupation by the foreign forces, particularly the Ethiopians. And some really nasty things were done to the Eritrean people, including food aid blockades during major droughts, the big famine, and We Are the World, 1985, with Michael Jackson. Most of that was taking place in Eritrea, and none of that food got to Eritrean people. You know, so there was the Soviet-backed Ethiopian regime of Mengistu used poison gas and cluster bombs and everything against the Eritrean people. So, you know, the world never said anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and the Palestinians and the Eritreans are both about the same size of people, both been going through the same, you know, struggle for independence since about the same time period. And, but, you know, if you look at what happened to the Eritreans, you look at what, we've been successful here. We've got our own country, we've got peace, we've got the fastest growing economy in Africa, and we see some major positive developments in Eritrea, while the Palestinians continue to suffer under this occupation. They're not united. They're fighting among each other. They've got two different leaders claiming, you know, Hamas and the left remnants and the Quisling regime of Abbas.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and then you've got all these Palestinians locked up in Gaza in this massive open-air prison. And in Egypt collaborating with the whole thing. Now, of course, the Mubarak regime collaborated with it, and that's understandable because basically it was installed by the West. But now you've got a Muslim Brotherhood claiming to be an independent leadership and continuing basically a blockade of Gaza. Why didn't the Egyptians open up the Rafah crossing and say, look, all mm-hmm. the people who wanted to flee this bombardment could flee? But they
yes.
wouldn't do that. They participated.
Or offered to protect them.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, the whole Arab world, the leadership, I think, was under enormous pressure from their own people. Because they could see on the news channels this brutal bombardment going on, the fact that the Gazans were basically helpless, mm-hmm. and that, you know, this is very crowded, the most crowded per person per mile in the world, getting blasted by the fourth largest military in the world, the Israelis, and yes. it was defenseless. And this put extreme pressure on the Arab government. And I think they said, listen, man, something's got to get done because, you know, we can't continue this. It's just our people are going to get crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So, a lot of people don't realize, though, that the price of food has been going up steadily. And, you know, with Mubarak, with his so-called Arab Spring, basically what it was an explosion caused by the fact that food hit record level. in Egypt, the price, you know, of bread, the price of cooking oil, the price of sugar were all hit record highs. And this is, and the first big demonstrations in Egypt were, came out of the very poorest of the poor communities in Cairo and the other cities. So this is, this pressure is coming on again. Food prices are starting to spiral. And we're going to be seeing, like you've seen protests in Jordan. So we're going to see more explosions. And the reality is in Egypt, nothing's changed. Things have gotten worse since Mubarak left. Life for the people is worse now than it was under Mubarak. So you're going to see more explosions in the Arab world. And I think people should recognize that. I think, you know, I've written about it in Africa. I've been talking about it in Kenya. The fact that the maize or corn prices are headed for record highs, and it's the number one staple food in Africa. And Africa's import dependent on maize. And you're going to see big explosions here as well because of food prices. And, you know, they're going to try to put a cover on it, but that's where it's all coming from. People are hungry. People, you know, that's the people, they talk about the Facebook revolution. 6% of the Egyptians have internet. You know, it's not, everybody's got satellite dish TV now, though. You know, so everybody's watching satellite TV, and that's what ignites these explosions. When, you know, when they're hungry and they sit and they're looking on satellite TV, can't take it anymore.
Wow, it's like the an old proverb. I can't eat promises, can I? Thomas Mountain, boy, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very, very much. And we'll look for that. Look for that documentary. Thanks again.
I'll be coming out with something on. I don't know how soon, but I you know, trying to get an analysis of what's really going on in the Congo because a lot of people don't realize. And I'm also looking at Ethiopia as headed for dissolution. So you might want to keep your eyes.
We are going to look out for that
with the next year. Okay, Phil.
Thanks an awful lot, Thomas. Bye bye,
okay.
Thomas Mountain.
Okay, take care,
Sean. And there's a great guy. You're listening to Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, Taylor@CIUT.FM, or go and also check us out on the web, Taylor-Report.com, where previous programs are available. Just in answer to Thomas's wish, we're going to be talking with Aimab Mugara, a very articulate Rwandan journalist who, like all healthy Rwandan journalists, lives abroad. Because if you're a healthy Rwandan journalist living in Rwanda, you won't be living very long. We want to find out about this caper that is taking place in the Congo. We are joined by Aimab Mugara right now. Are you there, Aimab?
Hi, Phil. How are you?
Very good. Aimab, we are getting this news today from all over the world that a very sophisticated military operation called the Rebels, M23, is trying to grab up. They've taken Goma and they're looking at Bukavu. What does M23 mean? And who are they?
Okay, so M23 officially is supposed to be this group of rebels who used to fight an earlier war, and then they had an agreement with the Congolese government, and that agreement was on March 23rd, a couple of years ago. And now they've taken up arms again to reinforce that agreement. But in truth, this rebel group is nothing but a front for the Rwandan government. And this is a war that has pretty much been going on for over two decades. We're talking about something that started even in Uganda by installing Museveni in 1986, and then went on to Rwanda in 1990. Mm-hmm. There was a regime change in Rwanda 4 years later. Mm-hmm. So that the same kind of soldiers are still now getting involved in attacking Congo. And seems that this may have been the goal from the very beginning, about 20 years ago, that the goal would have been Congo because of all its natural resources, all the wealth that it has in minerals.
And this is Aimab Mugara, who is from Rwanda, has written often about Rwanda, and knows the background. Today's the British paper, The Telegraph, I found this at Friends of the Congo, friendsofthecongo.org, but you can find an article there. They have an extensive interview with an individual named David Himbara, and he's described as an ex-right-hand man of Paul Kagame, and he says, why does the United States and London and British governments, and that would include Canada as far as I know, provide blank checks to the Rwandan government? He said, you're not exercising, you claim to have leverage, but you're not providing any leverage unless it is you want to continue the aggression. Can you tell us, do you know who Mr. Himbara is and why he would be credible?
Absolutely. So if there's anybody in the world that knows this Mr. Himbara, they would know that he worked very closely with Kagame, who is the current president of Rwanda. So Mr. Himbara was the private secretary to General Kagame, and he pretty much knows all the inside workings of that brutal regime that's going on in Rwanda. Mm-hmm. So his Telegraph interviews with the Telegraph, he says that Rwanda is a repressive regime, and the West is supporting a repressive regime. And this is an insider. This is someone who knows how this regime thinks. And in fact, the Rwandan government has tried to kill him where he is in exile in the UK. They've tried on multiple times and failed, thankfully. Mm-hmm. And so he basically details all the various crimes that Kagame's regime has done.
He's very categorical, by the way. He says there is no free press. There is no opposition. He says, how can you rationalize this government? It's very strong, and I mean, Telegraph is a rather well-known journal. The British government is sort of treading water, but there's signs of pretty serious corruption. One of the details in the story, and I don't know if you know about this, he says that at about a month or two ago, when the UN reported that these were the so-called rebels were actually Rwandan, the British government cut off a quarterly payment to the Rwandans, but the minister who did that resigned, and on the last day he was in office, cleared the payment, and said that he had the approval. So it's kind of like they wanted to have two impressions. One is they agreed with the criticism, but then they, at the last moment, went ahead and gave Rwanda the money.
Right. It's really true that the British government has a lot of its members who are very close to the Kagame regime. They had this program where many of those members, when they were still in the opposition, they went to Rwanda to like kind of a community service, mm-hmm. and it helped them clean up their image, because before they had this image of not caring about poor countries, mm-hmm. and Kagame gave them this opportunity to go and volunteer, and since then they seem to have been blinded, and anything he does, he goes around killing people, he goes around jailing people, torturing people, and they just totally become blind to it. Mm-hmm. And you're right that the last minister of foreign aid, he basically on his last day, he gave this money that had been blocked, mm-hmm. and then in recent hearings in front of the British Parliament, he was saying that he had the approval from the Prime Minister's office to release this money. So it wasn't just him acting alone. It seems to have been the entire system releasing this money to a group of people that there are various reports showing that they're supporting these rebels who have committed war crimes and crimes against humanity.
They just hoped no one would notice. Imad Mugara and is a journalist who can be found on the internet, his writings. And Imad, I notice a name that's missing now that I used to see a lot. And I want to ask you, where does this word belong and why aren't we hearing it? It's called the Banyamulenge. I hear about these rebels and they're talking about East Congo, but they're turning it into an East Congo story. My memory is 10 years ago, they used to always say, oh, there's the poor group called the Banyamulenge, and that's why Rwanda is there, to save the Banyamulenge. I also had a good friend, another Rwandan journalist, who one day put his hand on my shoulder and said, There are no Banya Malenge. Anyway, can you explain why they're not using the word anymore?
That is also something I have been wondering about. And it is true that most Congolese, they said, who is this Banya Malenge people? Because if you look at the history of Congolese, you're basically saying that, like, the word Banya Malenge means that you are from Malenge. But then they look around, there's no place called Malenge in Congo. So I don't know if that's part of it, that they've realized that the Congolese are going to be questioning this, like, if they keep on calling them the Banya Malenge.
Somebody in the public relations department said, delete that. We're going to go with a new word. This is Imam Mugara. And just on the historical record, there's also in this, they're now talking about the 1990s as though it's ancient history and Paul Kagame and his role. And they're trying to pick up the story from after he seized power. But his behavior at the moment in the Congo, isn't it rather like his behavior when he was a general in the Ugandan army in 1990?
Absolutely. Like, from the moment that Kagame joined the military, he hasn't been nothing but ruthless. Both in Uganda, he was well known for torturing his victims, both captured civilians as well as any rebels he would capture. Mm-hmm. They actually had a nickname for him in the Ugandan army. He was called Pilato, like kind of in memory of Pontius Pilate, the one who crucified Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And because he was that ruthless. And mm-hmm. then when his rebels attacked Rwanda in 1990, from 1990 to 1994, the ruthlessness of the rebels caused exodus. Like, any of the regions they would capture, any of the regions his forces captured, people just fled en masse. Like, there was more than a million internal refugees before 1994, mm-hmm. all running away from Kagame's massacres.
Mm-hmm.
And then from this is the third time that his army is going into Congo. There was 1996, 1998, And then stayed for many years since 1998, and now again they're back there.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, this war that he's been waging on Congo has resulted in more than 7 million dead. This mm-hmm. is the worst humanitarian disaster since World War II.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow, because it's in Congo, yes. the world seems to be ignoring it and pretending as if. Yes. Business as usual.
By the way, we love to now what everybody say, oh, we all hate what King Leopold did, but this is as bad as anything Leopold did.
That's quite true.
And for the same reason, isn't it? They want to extract what resources that area has.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems that the Congolese lives, if you have 1 million Congolese die for a little bit of the diamonds or coltan or any of those minerals, it's kind of acceptable. It's kind of nobody wants to do anything about it because there are these Western companies that are profiting from it, and those Western companies have the green light to continue exploiting these places at the expense of the local people who are being butchered.
Mm-hmm. Well, Imam Mugara, you have summarized it, in my view, very, very well. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Phil.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Imam Mugara, and you can find him on the net. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk to Rick Razov. Stop NATO. And we're back. Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. And check us out, taylor-report.com. And I'll just mention that website again. They have a fresh statement today about the matter in East Congo. Friends of the Congo, friendsofthecongo.org. And if you scroll down to the bottom of their statement, they have three or four links. And there's one link to the British paper, The Telegraph. And I really recommend it because it's an interview with this individual, David Himbara, that I was referring to, and as Imam Mugara just told us, if anybody knows the Rwandan leader, Paul Kagame, is this guy, because he was his private secretary. He had to flee. And his life has been threatened, and I think he's in South Africa. There have been attempts on the lives of several people there who have spoken out against Kagame. We're joined now by Rick Rosa for StopNATO.com. Are you there, Rick?
I sure am, Phil. Thanks for having me.
It's always great to talk to you, and your site is right on the point today because a rather serious development is taking place. Turkey has asked NATO to provide this thing called the Patriot missile to be placed, they hope, along the border with Syria and Iran, and of course Syria and Russia have all said something about this. What is going on here with NATO and this operation?
We had a talk several months ago, Phil, if you recall, when after Turkey deployed a Phantom F-4 warplane that violated the airspace of Syria and was shot down this past July, that Turkey, for the first time, not the last, it's already attempted this twice, has gone to NATO headquarters in Brussels and asked for the invocation of either Article 4 or Article 5. Article 4 is mutual consultations between the 28 members of the NATO alliance. NATO military bloc. Article 5, of course, which may be around the corner, is a much more serious proposition. It's really a mutual war clause, a military assistance clause. And the discussion we had, I believe, last July went over old territory, and that the last time Turkey had NATO invoke Article 4 in its alleged defense or behalf was in 2003, immediately before the attack on Iraq, and the practical results of which were the deployment of Patriot Advanced Capability 3 interceptor missiles to Turkey on the Iraqi border. So we're seeing a frighteningly reminiscent development right now, in addition to AWACS aircraft, of course, being sent by NATO countries. And in 1991, prior to the first war with Iraq, Operation Desert Storm, NATO countries also deployed Patriot interceptor missiles to Turkey. So, you know, if the pattern holds true, as in 1991 and 2003, the deployment of the NATO missile interceptors is a prelude, an immediate prelude to war.
And the language in the articles that I'm seeing at your site, stopnato.com, and by the way, to get that, you go to rickrosoff.wordpress.com, I believe.
Yeah, thank you.
And it's interesting how they're using the same terminology. They're talking about a no-fly zone. It seems to, such as that they established over Libya, then made it a NATO-fly zone and bombed the devil out of Libya. Clearly, if they put that weaponry there, they can begin to shoot down Syrian planes and establish a secure area for their friends, right?
Yeah, you're hitting on a key point there, Phil, that this is a backhanded way or a back alley, you know, maneuver to de facto enforce a no-fly zone without a NATO aircraft, which could be shot down by Syrian air defenses, particularly as the Patriot Advanced Capability 3 interceptor missiles are of a much more advanced quality and range. Than they were even in 2003 and certainly in 1991. In fact, the PAC-3, the new Patriot, has something referred to as the segment enhancement capability, which I read earlier today, perhaps yesterday, an estimate that the Patriot missiles now have a range of 600 kilometers. Mm-hmm. I suspect they could have a range longer than that, in which case, as you're mentioning, they can only shoot down ballistic missiles through, you know, hit-to-kill kinetic interception, but also cruise missiles and aircraft. Mm-hmm. So what you may see, in fact, in northern Syria is that NATO enforces a no-fly regime, much as in Libya, as you recalled, preparatory to, first of all, to enhance the capability of their proxy fighting forces on the ground, so-called Free Syrian Army, which as of the last 24-48 hours is reported to be engaged in fairly fierce conflict with Kurdish forces in northern Syria, which would be, you know, to the benefit of Turkey, as the Kurdish groups in northern Syria are accused by Ankara of having ties with the Kurdistan Workers' Party in Turkey. Mm-hmm. So I think what we're seeing is a revelation of what the Turkish NATO strategy has been in Syria for a long time, though not acknowledged until recently, which is a continuation of the, you know, the brutal and decades-long counterinsurgency war waged by Turkey against Kurdish autonomy advocates, PKK in the first instance, and affiliated or sympathetic groups in other countries, including Iraq and now Syria.
Mm-hmm. This is Rick Rosoff. It's rickrosoff.wordpress.com. And, you know, the articles that I read there today, your most recent ones, they raise a specter that maybe something else is also afoot. In other words, you know, this becomes a nice opportunity for NATO, who might have some other additional plans if they there's talk of, you know, how this might be of assistance in other areas in the region. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Repeatedly now, as recently as a couple of days ago, the General Secretary of NATO, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, again used, I think, an expression well worth taking note of, though generally I don't think people have paid enough attention to it, when he refers to the Turkish-Syrian border as being NATO's southeastern border. That, of course, technically is correct, as Turkey is a NATO member. But I think it's more ominous than that. What he's really signaling, at least to the initiated in the ruling elite in the West, is that this is now the southeasternmost border of NATO, and that not only are we going, is NATO going to supposedly defend you know, the powerhouse that is the military powerhouse that is Turkey, and which needs no defense, certainly not from the Syrian military. But in fact, is you know, suggesting that NATO's border is, that's the point from which NATO can launch military operations, as opposed to that as a border that needs to be defended by NATO. And we're looking at, I think what you're alluding to in part also, Phil, is the fact that it's not only Syria that is threatened. You mentioned Iran, and Iraq is the third country. Turkey has been pursuing increasingly reckless and aggressive military attacks inside Iraq, dangerously close to the border of Iran, and has moved military forces going back to last August, you know, rather formidable forces at times, directly up to the Syrian border. So they threaten no fewer than three countries. And those are three countries that, as most of your listeners know, in the case of Syria and Iran, it's no surprise, that have pursued, in defiance of global trends over the last 20 years, independent foreign policy orientations and practices. But, you know, as many of your listeners may not know, you know, the current government of al-Maliki in Iraq has taken in recent months a fairly independent position vis-a-vis the United States. Even at one point, though, it now seems to be in jeopardy, you know, signing with a fairly colossal arms deal with Russia. And statements by al-Maliki and other members of the current Iraqi government in Baghdad have, you know, openly and unequivocally demanded that no foreign military intervention occur in Syria. So, well, you know, what the U.S. may, U.S. and NATO may want to do is clean up, you know, the broader Middle East, if you will, by eliminating the three sources of resistance right now.
Actually, yes, we have that. They tend to open a new deck with us about every other day. I mean, for example, Iraq and Syria, Russia have all had a little problem on this matter of overflights, you know, planes. I notice, and I wonder if you know, what the U.S. got rather concerned that Iraq might be tolerating or being acting as though they're sovereign and allowing planes to pass to Syria.
Yeah, I mean, that they would be, of course, chastised for doing that, for exercising their sovereign right to determine which nation's planes can cross over there. You know, their territory en route to their own country. But I think you're perhaps also speaking in regard to a Syrian airplane that had left a Russian airport and was detained without plausible justification and, you know, rather crudely by the Turkish government. A similar thing happened to an Armenian aircraft shortly thereafter, where, in essence, Turkey is enforcing a variation of a no-fly zone by preventing planes you know, traveling through its territory to arrive in Syria in contravention of international law.
This is Rick Rosoff, rickrosoff.wordpress.com. And, you know, certainly we in Canada and in the U.S. population ought to be paying close attention to this phenomenon called NATO. I was wondering if maybe they were stumbling over their own nomenclature here. They have a thing called the Patriot missile. If it's a Patriot, what's it doing in NATO? NATO is not a country.
Yeah, I mean, it's an American, I believe, Boeing corporation builds the Patriot, and initially it was, you know, appealing to, let's say, circa 1991.
Must be the occasional person scratches their head and say, well, Patriot, a Patriot of what country?
Yes, that's a good point. When you deploy German and Dutch U.S.-made or designed Patriot missiles to Turkey against Syria, and what, you know, whose patriotism are we speaking about? I mean, that's a valid question.
Yeah, this is Rick Rizzoff. By the way, Rick, I noticed something I hadn't realized, and it takes a crisis to notice things, that there seems to be a kind of, there's an arrangement where Turkey is in possession of some sort of exercise of nuclear weapons. I don't know how much authority over them they have, but according to Wikipedia, that they are, there's a certain number of nuclear weapons that is in their territory.
That's correct. These are B-61 tactical nuclear bombs. The question about how much autonomy or decision-making Turkey has, it's part of actually a NATO program called NATO Burden Sharing or
Burden Sharing
or Military Sharing. And the exact terms are, there are four other countries in Europe, of course, that have U.S. nuclear weapons stationed on the air bases. These are Germany, Netherlands, Italy, and Belgium. Up until a few years ago, Britain was the sixth. And in the case of the nuclear sharing or the burden sharing, the bombs are American, but the warplanes designated to deliver them to their targets are those of the respective host nation.
Uh-huh.
So that with the B-61s and the Incirlik Air Base in Turkey, according to the NATO terms, they would be, Turkish bombers would be equipped with these, and they would deliver the nuclear payload.
This would be a kind of a form of a Dr. Strangelove with a Turkish accent.
Whatever the Turkish translation of that surname is.
I could imagine the pilot who just have to have a different costume. To me, that's a very accurate film, by the way. I don't know how. But we're speaking to Rick Rizzoff. It's rickrizzoff.wordpress.com. And Rick, on this program, we've been asking some people about this crisis, seems to be developing between China and Japan. And I know that you have spoken about this as the U.S. has, I think the operative word is pivoting their policy, pivoting in South Asia. Some of the reports are pretty alarming. We see pictures of confrontation of ships, and we see huge demonstrations in China, and some pretty interesting language coming out of Japan of people talking about, well, let's stop calling ourselves a defense force and make a full-blooded army, et cetera. Should we be looking at here?
You're looking at not only Sino-Japanese conflict over what the Japanese call the Senkaku and the Chinese the Diaoyu Islands, but you're also looking at a much broader scenario of several island disputes. They include ones between Japan and Russia, you know, the South Kuril Islands. What Japan persists in referring to as the Northern Territories. That term, by the way, has been echoed by U.S. State Department personnel.
Shouldn't somebody remind them that actually we were allies of the Chinese?
And the Russians.
And the Russians.
But what you're seeing is, you know, just clearly revanchism on the behalf of Tokyo, where several prime ministers in a row have, gone to the infamous cemetery where Japanese soldiers are buried, including Class A war criminals, knowing that to do that symbolically, if not practically, will incense not only China, but North Korea, South Korea, and anyone else who suffered at the hands of Japanese imperialism in World War II. But also that and the watering down, if not ultimately the elimination of the Article 9 provision in the Japanese Constitution, penned by the United States, of course, as you know, Phil, that prevents Japan from actively engaging in military operations abroad, or engaging in what's called, this is one of the greatest euphemisms in the world, mutual self-defense, or mutual collective defense with other countries. Well, in fact, Japan has been doing that. It sent a military contingent to Iraq after the invasion of 2003. it not so much in support of NATO's International Security Assistance Force initially, but in support of the U.S.'s Operation Enduring Freedom. They had warships and or military vessels in the Indian Ocean that were supplying American warships. But as of perhaps 2 years ago, Japan did send its first official military contingent to serve under NATO command in Afghanistan, the International Security Assistance Force. These are medics initially, but, you know, at least the foot is in the door. And roughly 2 years ago, Japan was welcomed by the United States and NATO allies to set up a military command in Africa, in the northeast Horn of Africa nation of Djibouti. And this is the first, the establishment of the first overseas military base by Japan since World War II. So we're seeing the remilitarization of Japan, and with the U.S. standing behind Japan, and also in the South China Sea behind both the Philippines and Vietnam in relation to island disputes with China, it seems to be a full-court press. Well, the U.S. will support anyone who has a territorial conflict with China.
Yeah, it reminds me, on this program, you did tell us that there has been a radical change, and it's certainly evident on the front pages of the paper now in Myanmar, where it turns out that the President Obama has gone to visit and welcomed by whomever is running the place, and that while the evidence of a government and totally intolerant of the Muslim population of the country is their crimes are ignored, and there's a brand new friendship there.
Geopolitics is everything. Not that we would wish it, though. I'm sure you have the same aversion as I do, you know, to the cynical, mechanistic nature of geopolitics. But we do have to acknowledge.
Yes. Well, they've got nothing on Orwell in terms of yesterday we hated him. Today, no, he's okay.
Yes, I mean, this was
long time friend.
Right. This was all foreshadowed or really concretized by Hillary Clinton's visit to Myanmar. About a year ago. And prior to that, of course, in the summer of 2010, when Clinton went to the Association of Southeast Asian Nations summit in Hanoi and took up cudgels on behalf of those nations who do have territorial disputes with China over island disputes in the South China Sea. And it was clear at that point the U.S. was recruiting the entire 10-nation Association of Southeast Asian Nations as a renewal, if you will, Phil, of the Cold War era military blocs like CENTO and CETO. And that it doesn't then surprise me that after Obama wins re-election, the first three countries he visits are Burma, Cambodia, and Thailand. If I'm not mistaken, he's the first U.S. president ever to go to Burma, Myanmar, and Cambodia. And this, you know, would have to be seen pretty clearly in Beijing as an attempt to wean away from China what few allies they have left in the world. But, you know, surely in the Asia-Pacific region and, you know, transfer them into the U.S. column.
It certainly points up over and over why we need to understand who are the players are. This is rickrozov.wordpress.com. When you see Russia say, now, wait a minute, you put a missile there and you might be into a bigger problem than you know. Right. I mean, there is a language. I remember Ariel Sharon used it. I've always liked it. He said, "We create facts on the ground," and the problem with that is that the other guy who might be your opponent, he doesn't wait around for your politicians, right, to make explain things. If you do something that he knows is meant for him, he can send you the same kind of message back.
Well, we have to recall with we started off the discussion about the deployment of Patriot missiles to Turkey at the Syrian border. In May of 2010, the U.S. Stationed what is going to be a permanent Patriot battery in Poland, in the city of Morog, which is only some 35 or 40 miles from Russian territory, the Kaliningrad enclave. And that we also have to remember the very beginning of this year that under NATO auspices, the U.S. Based a X-band transportable interceptor missile radar in Turkey, which is one of the same nature that was placed in Israel in 2008. So that, you know, I remember writing at the time 4 years ago when the X-band radar was sent to Israel, it has a range of 2,900 miles.
Whoa.
you know, which overshoots Tehran, you know, Iran, any number of times, right? And is enough, if I'm doing my calculations correctly, to take in the entire western border of Russia and most of the southern border, 2,900 miles if it's aimed in that direction. And now you have something comparable in Turkey. So the Patriot missiles on the Syrian border are not to be seen in isolation from the other events I'm mentioning, such as, you know, the Patriot missiles in Poland, which is the first, you know, presumably permanent deployment of U.S. missiles in Europe since the end of the Cold War, of course, and the first in Eastern Europe, the former Warsaw Pact country. They're to be followed, of course, by more advanced interceptor missiles in Poland and in Romania.
Yeah, and again, I mean, people, when they, we received the kind of coded words and the blandishments, but for those who are the targets, they just get down to the brass tacks. Did he just put something there that could harm us?
Yes.
And they have to behave, react based on that. They don't, you know, the language they're not too interested in. They want to know if it's a threatening conduct.
Yeah, I recall a comment. I forget really what the subject matter is. I guess it doesn't matter. There's so many potential causes for the comment, but a leading Russian, I believe, military official, perhaps in the last 18 months, who said wars have been started for far less than this.
Yes, and it should be underlined. We're speaking to Rick Razov. It's stopnato.com, but you go to rickrazov.wordpress.org. I guess, unless, if I have a moment to ask you, Israel has recently, just prior to their upcoming election, decided to pummel Gaza. What is Israel's relationship to NATO?
They're a leading member, one might argue the prototype member, in a NATO military partnership called the Mediterranean Dialogue. To date, there are six other nations, and they're Mauritania, Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, Egypt, and Jordan. But Israel is the first to have been granted a few years ago an individual partnership program.
An individual partnership program.
Program through the Mediterranean Dialogue. And we now know, right from the leading NATO officials, that Libya is going to be the next member of the Mediterranean Dialogue. And if Western plans go, heaven forfend they do, but if they go according to plan, Syria and Lebanon would be candidate members of that military alliance. So there's a special relationship obtaining between Israel and NATO in a number of ways. For example, Israel is the only country outside of Europe that remains in the area of responsibility of U.S. European Command, whose top military commander, currently Admiral Stavridis, is simultaneously Supreme Commander Allied Forces Europe, that is NATO's chief commander, and that's been the case, you know, over the decades. The two posts are held simultaneously. So that NATO, being in the area of responsibility of European Command, in an essence, is within NATO's ambit. And no other country is in that situation. The only other exception, I think is a noteworthy one considering what's going on there now, is that Egypt is the only country in Africa that remains in Central Command, where Israel realistically ought to be. But instead is in European Command. We also know that 2 days before the Israeli, the beginning of the U.S. Israeli operation against the Gaza Strip, that the U.S. and Israel finished what was billed as being the largest ever joint military exercise between the two countries in Israel, Austere Challenge 2012, which was a missile interception, drills, which included U.S. Patriot missiles, U.S. Standard Missile 3s, and the the triad of Israeli interceptor missile programs, Iron Dome, David Sling, and the Arrow systems. And then 2 days later, Operation Pillar of Defense is launched now. And then they get to test out the systems that the U.S. and Israel had just been testing up until 2 days before.
About your coincidences.
Yeah, what an astonishing coincidence.
Rick Razov, rickrazov.wordpress.com. Rick, it's very a pleasure to talk to you and very informative. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Phil.
Okay. Bye-bye. This is Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Write to us, Taylor at CIUT.fm. Carol, thanks very much. Phil, thanks very much. And we'll see you next week.